biggest lesson that I learned there is those X factors, you must treat them as icing on the cake, never as the cake itself. Every property needs to stand on its own merit. If there are good things happening, it's icing, but never the cake.
Welcome everyone to the Road Less Traveled Show. This is a show about people that were successful in a previous career that left that career to go down a different path. I'm your co-host, Richard Coyne.
And I'm your co-host, Bill Zahler.
On today's show, we have Neil Bawa with us. Neil, we're so glad you joined us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I like the way that you've structured the show with, you know, past, you know, successes. So I don't get to talk about that very often.
Well, Neil, absolutely. We appreciate you being on the Road Less Traveled show. And I guess to start with the first question for the listeners that don't know your background, can you tell us a little about your initial career and then what you've transitioned into?
Absolutely. So I'm a technologist, you know, a geek, a nerd, degrees in computer science, specialty is in data science, or a data scientist, and came to the US in 1997 and started work as a technologist building large enterprise networks for Cisco and others through my company. Worked my way up the ladder, became COO by 1999, and then took that company, was 10 employees at that point, took it to a full exit. We sold to a very large private equity firm in 2013. So a 14-year process, so very brick and mortar, not dot-com-ish at all. Building it up for 10 employees to 400 before we sold it in 2013.
Wow, excellent. And then what did you transition to after you made the exit?
Well, you know, it wasn't really a short transition. It was a very long transition. So by 2008, that company had 300 employees. We had huge cash flow. I was a partner. So I was, you know, I had the big fat tech salary and the big fat partnership check at the end of the year. So I was, you know, I live in California, so I was paying, you know, 53% in taxes and Medicare taxes. And so I go into my boss's office and I basically say, Paul, I am not working for you. I'm working for the IRS. And he says, I know. You know, and I'm like, did you expect me to burst in here? He's like, I've been expecting you to burst in here for years, Neil. I mean, you've got to find a way to mitigate this. And I said, so what did you do? And he said, ugly apartments. And I'm like, ugly apartments? I don't know what that really means. So he says, okay. You know, he calls in his secretary and buys me a ticket to go to Los Angeles the following week. And then we go to LA and he walks me into these really ugly apartments. And I'm like, Paul, these are really ugly. And right, because I've never really been in an apartment before, right? I, you know, when I came to the US, I lived with my family. And then because I was a technologist, I moved straight into a very nice place. And he's like, I know. And I'm like, no, I mean, they're ugly. And he says, I know. And I'm like, this is my mentor is trying to teach me something, right? He keeps saying this. And his obvious point is that ugliness is beautiful. So he goes and explains the whole cash thing. And he hands me the big, you know, rich dad, poor dad book. And I read that and I read some of the apartment books. And I'm like, this is really incredible. This taxation stuff is just mind blowing. This is like, it's almost like, how could this be legal, right? So I'm like in denial for 6 months that real estate hall has all these taxation benefits. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me about this 10 years ago? And it was like, I don't think you were ready for this, right? You have to be ready. You have to get frustrated. And that's the point where you really, you know, roll over. And so I, you know, from 2008 to 2014, I basically bought real estate for myself. And I published a massive amount of information on data science. So I became kind of a mini nerdy celebrity with people inviting me to conferences and meetups and things like that. And then at the end of the conference, they would say, so what are you selling? And I'm like, I'm not selling anything. I'm running a technology company. I'm just telling you what I do for my, you know, personal portfolio, which is, you know, doing pretty well because of all this data science. And so people started to follow me because they knew that I actually wasn't selling anything in real estate. And so when the company got sold in 2013, I sort of stuck around for a year to see if they wanted, you know, if I wanted to go along for a second ride with them. And I really didn't. I think that, the, you know, let's just say, you know, private equity firms are very different from the build your own company form. It's very bureaucratic. So after a year, I was very happy to kind of step down and start a formal real estate career, which, you know, started basically in 2014. And at this point, we have about 800 investors, about $1 billion invested into our project. So it's been a pretty nice journey, but it was really a long transition because I started in 2008 and didn't really jump in until 2014.
Oh, yeah, that's quite a transition. I think we met Was it around 2015, 2016, I think, at a conference 16, you spoke at in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I still remember the presentation on the demographic movements and how you could track that. And it was very, very well done, very informative. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been doing that for years. I kind of sort of developed it over time. It's called location magic. And I use that all the time. As you know, I tend to be very aggressive in investing in small cities, and nobody would know that better than you. You know, we've partnered twice together. And the first time was at very traditional big city like Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And then the second time was basically a pure tertiary metro called Greenville. And when you bought that project to me, I called my development manager and I say, hey, where does Greenville show up in our matrix? And his answer was, it's in seventh position. It's up 21 in the last 6 months. And up 21 is very difficult in our matrix because we're tracking 400 metros. So the magic word was not that it was in seventh position. It was that it had skyrocketed up 21 positions in my location magic matrix. And I think we made an agreement in a single day to say, yes, we are going to work together on this project. And obviously you guys had a phenomenal 50%+ IRR exit on that one.
Yeah. Plus 60. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Great. It's a great location. Greenville is just such a great city. You know, so much growth in terms of jobs, in terms of population, and even the rent growth has been phenomenal. So yeah, great city.
And that's what I do with location magic. My focus is on finding Greenvilles. And, you know, there's many others. I mean, I'm happy to throw some of these out. You know, right now, Idaho Falls is a Green Hill, and that's in Idaho. That's the second largest city in Idaho. The entire set of cities south of Tampa going to Cape Corals and Fort Myers are like Greenville. So they're kind of, you know, you see Bradenton there, you see Port Charlotte, you know, Cape Coral, Fort Myers. There's a few others that are in that list. Sarasota is in the list, right? Sarasota may be too expensive, but, you know, that corridor is basically has the same benefits that Greenville, South Carolina has in terms of compression. It's in between major cities that are pushing at it from both sides. I saw that with Greenville, right? We did a one-day analysis after you bought that project to us. And I was like, I love the amount of goods that are traveling here between Raleigh, Charlotte, and Atlanta. It's a massive corridor. There's huge movement here. And I haven't seen that anywhere else except for this Tampa, Cape Coral, Fort Myers corridor. And then anything between Austin and San Antonio, there's small cities and big cities. New Braunfels, San Marcos, Kyle, Buda. Those cities are absolutely mind-bogglingly astonishing in terms of getting compression, both from, you know, Austin, which is, the number one tech hub in the US, and then San Antonio, which is, you know, very fast growing by itself, not a tech hub, but very fast growing. So that's what we do. We track corridors in the US, and then we also track small cities in the US, and predominantly we invest in small cities. So you might say, you know, Austin's not small, San Antonio's not small. Yeah, but I'm buying large projects in New Braunfels and San Marcos and Killeen and Fredericksburg and Taylor. I mean, none of those are Austin, San Antonio. They're just close.
Right. In a path of progress, as you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
On that. Yeah.
Yep.
That's great.
Nice. Nice. So, Neil, as you look back to your technology career and what you did as a technologist and all that good stuff, is there a funny story that you can share along the way, something that made you scratch your head? Why am I doing this?
I think maybe I can share a sad story, because I think people really learn from, you know, bad experiences. So, as I was, you know, doing my math, and this was early days, I really wasn't that good. And, you know, because a lot of the structure that we have today was missing, you know, we found this project that was in South Shore, in Chicago. And we basically said, what we learned was through an inside source that was a friend of Obama. So Obama's wife was born in South Shore. They're very tied to the South Shore of Chicago. Both of them are. And this inside friend told us that the park that was next to this property was going to win the bid for the Obama Presidential Library. And so it was not just a library, it was a $2 billion project, mixed use, restaurants, all kinds of stuff. I mean, they were building an iconic destination in South Shore, a few hundred yards from where Michelle Obama was born. And because this was insider information, I was very excited about it, right? And then I learned that a group called the McCaffertys were buying the U.S. Steel plant, and they did go ahead and make that purchase. And U.S. Steel was a mile away south of this property. The park was north of the property, and they were building 5,500 homes, and they had already paid $55 million to the city Chicago to build an off-ramp, like a freeway off-ramp exit on South Shore Drive. Now, none of this stuff had really been built. No houses were built. The library wasn't approved. And so I bought this property along with my partners, and the property was not good, but we believed that it would, you know, go up in quality. And, you know, and what I learned from this project, it wasn't a good ending, by the way. This wasn't a happy ending project. I held on as long as I could, but eventually the property was bleeding and I had to let it go. What I learned is that when we look at the path of progress, when we look at what is possible in a market, that doesn't mean that you buy a low quality product. That doesn't mean you buy something that's bleeding, because many of these projects get delayed. The Obama Presidential Library got delayed by 5 years by the Friends of Washington Park, or whatever the name of the park was, suing them because they didn't like, you know, all this construction in a portion of the park that they were in. It was a big neighborhood park. And then the McCaffertys got into a dispute with the city of Chicago and abandoned the entire project. So either one of those projects happened, my project would have been a home run. But as it is, I didn't look at the existing cash flow. The biggest lesson that I learned there is those X factors, you must treat them as icing on the cake, never as the cake itself, mm-hmm. right? And that was a painful lesson that I learned with my investors who lost money, by the way. I wasn't the primary at that point. I didn't have my own company, so it's not the company that I run at this point in time. I was a junior partner in another company, and I certainly had a role to play there. So I think the painful learning is every property needs to stand on its own merit. If there are good things happening, it's icing, but never the cake. That's the lesson that I learned. And it's the most painful lesson that I've learned. And since then, I've never invested even in a market like South Shore, right? Mm-hmm. I always invest in the most robust markets in the US. It allowed me, the pain of that allowed me to keep building my metrics to the point where now we spend about 200 hours a month improving our dashboards and metrics and finding these unique locations. A lot of it just came from the sheer pain of being up at 2 a.m. staring at the ceiling, not believing what happened. You know, I mean, the library getting, you know, even if it had gotten delayed by 2 years, we would have made it, but it was 5 years.
Ugh. Wow.
Like you said, there's things you can control and things you can't control, right? But yeah. Like I said, as you've adjusted the risk matrix and what you focus on to make those adaptations, yeah, I mean, it's like I said, all part of the whole learning process on that. That's great.
I think it's been a great journey, but it hasn't come without its bumps.
Sure. Right. Absolutely. And that's the lessons, like you said, the lesson you shared there, that's how people remember those lessons, right? If you had nothing but smooth sailing, you won't really learn anything for the when you have the hard time.
I think so. I've learned a lot more from the failures that came early with this other company. And Grow Capitalist has been lucky. We've had, you know, about a 36 IRR on our 7 exits. We've never had a project that lost money. We've never had a project that didn't make double digits, because I think that we benefited from all these bad experiences before I opened my own company.
Right. That's great. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Neil, what was the deciding factor that had you transition when you're in the private equity space and then transition full-time into real estate? Was there any one thing, or just kind of something was building up over time in the back of your mind, how you're going to run it, start a company that focused on real estate?
It was quality of life. For me, you know, what happens in technology is as you get better and better at your job, they keep paying you more and more, but they're never, I mean, the amount of hours that you're spending are always increasing. And right in technology, success simply means you work harder and you make more money. And, you know, if you live in California, the government takes 53% of that money. So I think that the biggest driver was that, like everybody else that has the big fat tech salary, I became afraid that my boss would basically replace me with 3 young guys and still save some money. That never happened. I mean, you know, he loved me and we went all the way through, but you have this thing is in your mind all the time, which is if I don't work 12 hours a day and I don't work on Saturdays and I don't work on Sunday and I don't appear to my boss to be available every 6 seconds when he, you know, sends a text message, then I'm not worth my job. And a lot of technologists, you know, feel that way. So to me, it was really about quality of life. So, and initially when I opened my own real estate company, I was spending more hours than I was. But what happens in real estate is that you do have the ability to scale up. So now I work 30 hours weeks. So I'm running a company two different companies. One's a company that has $1 billion valuation itself, and one that has $1 billion in asset, two separate, you know, companies. But I'm working 30 hours a week because real estate scales. It provides enough profit to hire mid-level managers and to also hire a team in the Philippines. So we have a massive team in the Philippines, 22 full-time employees. They have their own managers. They have their own directors. And then we have a bunch of people here in the US that have taken the load off of me. So I can actually be a true entrepreneur, or I would say not entrepreneur. I'm not an entrepreneur anymore. I'm a business owner. And I just couldn't see how you get there with technology, because even the guys that are running the $1 billion companies are still working 75 hours a week. I mean, Elon is sleeping on the factory floor, right? Yeah. When they have a bad quarter. So I just got to the point, guys, where I did not want that life. I want to play golf on Fridays, and that's what I do right now. You know, Friday is my golf day. If there's something urgent going on, they'll call me into the office, but otherwise they know not to bother me. And I just don't see how that works in the tech world. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I'm still in the tech world because I found that applying technology to a real estate business is far more profitable than applying technology to a tech business. Because when you apply technology to a tech business, you have a 6-month advantage, and then 10 other smarter people than you catch up and they kind of leave you in their dust. But with real estate, when you apply technology, and I'll give you some examples if you want them, you can keep those for a long, long time. You can keep those advantages almost forever.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's chasing the same thing in the original role, but you're bringing in, yeah. Can you give an example or two of some of the new technology things you've implemented that's really helped you differentiate yourself?
Absolutely. So I'll give you one that's a very interesting example. So this is a property that we've just it's on sale, hasn't sold. It's in Utah, and so this property is in Salt Lake City, which gets very, very hot in the summer and gets very, very cold in the winter. And so we were we had covered parking spaces, and when we went into the property a year later, still only like 10 covered parking spaces are sold, and the rest of them are not sold. So we talked to the property manager and we push him and say, hey, make phone calls to people. And they show us proof that they made these phone calls and nothing has come out of it, right? People don't want them. They don't want to pay $50 for a covered parking space. And we're like, we need this to make our business plan work. So we assign it to our team in the Philippines. So we have a person in the Philippines that's part of our efficiency center team. And the efficiency center was asked to look at the temperature in Salt Lake City and then do some tasks. So these tasks were in a project management software called Asana. And basically the trigger was, if the temperature today in Salt Lake City is going to be over 95 degrees or under 0 degrees, make a phone call, because only on those days do people care about covered parking. When your car's 120 degrees, you want covered parking. Or when there's a foot of snow that you're basically digging your car out of, right? So it was like minus 10 degrees or 90 degrees. And so they would check in the morning, and if the temperatures were not going to be that high or that low, they would just not call. And if they were, they would call. And it took us about 4 months, but we leased up, you know, 40 spaces. So just do the math on this, right? 40 spaces were leased up at $50 each. So we're making $2,000 a month. That's $24,000 a year. And we spent about, I don't know, $250 total in a virtual assistant that cost $5 an hour, right? And you might say, yeah, well, you know, it's not a huge number, right? I mean, it's $24,000 a year. Yes, but we owned that property for 6 years. So that we basically made, using this technique, we made $144,000, right? But the big pop came at exit, because at exit, when we put the property into contract, all the spaces were leased, and they had been leased for the last 4 or 5 years. So the buyer basically accepted that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that $24,000 of additional NOI, we sold the property at 4 cap. You know, Salt Lake City is a very low cap market. We got a 25x multiplier on $24,000. So we made $700,000 additional dollars on exit by spending a few hundred dollars a year on people in the Philippines. And the structure and the process is to go with that. I have dozens of examples like that, but that's really a perfect example that tells you just the multipliers in real estate are so amazing, especially if you can sell a property for 5 cap or 4 cap. And prove it to the buyer that, look, these do stay occupied. And they didn't know that we were forcing them to stay occupied.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. No, that's a great example, Neil.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah.
So Neil, as you shifted over to the real estate side, you know, leaving the tech world, moving full time, you had already kind of gradual process, like you said, you know, were there some obstacles you encountered along the way?
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle was getting our message out there. So what I find is that it's actually easier to interest investors with a rah, 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 we're going to make a lot of money sort of, you know, messaging. And I'm sort of dry. I'm the technology guy. I'm the numbers guy. And so for me, the big challenge was I'm not a promoter by nature, right? And now I think I'm more flamboyant with, you know, having done these 200 podcasts for, you know, so many years. But when I started out and Bill sort of saw me there at the very beginning, I wasn't that flamboyant. I was basically trying to make a point. And so the big challenge was how do we find enough investors to buy the projects that we want? And the projects we're trying to buy are in these small tertiary markets that nobody's ever heard of. So obviously it's harder to get people to give you their money when your message is really all about numbers. And I think that we solved it in many different ways. So we sat down and said, one, we build a brand that is all around numbers. So, you know, for example, my nickname in the industry is the mad scientist of multifamily. I go to conferences where I'm like the token tech guy that comes in and does math and shows interesting things on screen around numbers. And then they have a bunch of promoters that, you know, are not really talking about numbers. So I created a little niche for myself as the guy that comes in and does all these tech, you know, visitory things. Then we also learned how to promote all the awesome stuff that my team in the Philippines was doing by creating little videos that showed, you know, all of the benefits. Like, for example, they were involved in a pre-leasing. When you pre-lease, you usually lease under market price for a new property because you have a big construction loan. And so you're really in a hurry. But what we did was we had the Philippines team build a website and talk to people on Facebook Marketplace and create a lot of rah-rah about this property. And then when lease up actually started and we could, you know, get people in, they already had a list of 1,000 people that they'd created. We ended up raising leases, rents 7 times during lease up. And at the last 20% of the property was leased 20% above market because we had so many people that right. were looking at it. So we basically did something that's very hard to do. We actually leased above market for lease up. And so we took that and we encapsulated that into videos and concepts and ideas and emails and sent it out. And eventually we ended up with basically a very geeky audience. We ended up with a very nerdy, geeky audience, technologists from Silicon Valley and Austin, loved the geekiness of our company and were all in for these kinds of technology experiments. So these people, I could go and explain to them, well, instead of investing in New York or Los Angeles, and I live in California, I'm going to go invest in this tiny little city called St. George with 107,000 people. And here's why you're going to make a truckload of money. By the way, the property did make a truckload of money. Because those people could follow the math. They could actually follow the mathematics that we had, the metrics that we had. And they were like, wow, I love this. So we basically created that 2% of real estate investors that are extremely nerdy by nature. And that became our audience. And I traveled the US, and that's how I met both of you, basically going to 20 conferences a year, just staying on this one message of mathematics and how it affects real estate. And then we ended up doing 20 or 30 things. We created a course on Udemy, which is basically a course that allows you to rank cities in the US by using numbers. And right now there's 10,000 students taking it. So there's 10,100 students taking it. We have 1,000 five-star reviews. It's the most popular real estate course on Udemy because eventually the geeks and the nerds found us.
Right.
That's excellent. Nice. Well, and I guess, Neil, from I know you had even a higher education background before in technology, one of your earlier companies too. So you're, you know, obviously had a good background of that in real estate, in the numbers. As you look back at what was like one of your first victories when you transitioned into more of the real estate side, it could be the technology side or the first deal or however you look at it, but that really solidified that you were on the right path. Like this is definitely a path forward. I can make it, build a large company this way.
So I'll give you an example. So one of my first properties that we purchased was a property called Park Canyon. And, you know, that property is being sold at this point in time. So we go in and the property is lovely. Everything's going well, right? We And we're like, okay, we're probably going to, instead of a 15 or 16 IRR, we're probably going to get out at 20 IRR, right? At that point, cap compression hadn't happened. So we were just looking at rents. And one of the things that we do at our company is we have a brainstorming session once every 3 months where we look at what are the accelerators that we can create in our business? What are the disruptors that we can create in the business? To create victory, you have to put in work. So yeah. Your question is about victories, right? But there's a lot of work that goes in. So in our brainstorming sessions, we'd come up with 10 completely batshit crazy ideas on how to create accelerators. And 9 of them might fail after some more probing work was done on them. But one that came out that really stuck around was that no syndicator in the US was ever going to the city and checking to see how many units a property was zoned for. So they would buy a property that was 150 units, and then they wouldn't go to the city and check to see if the property was zoned for more units, because a lot of the properties built in the 70s and 80s, land was cheap. And often they wouldn't build all of the units simply because some of the land was sloped. So they would basically say, oh, this is going to cost us more. We're just going to build 150 units and let the other stuff just be trees and foliage. Now that land turned into gold in the subsequent 30 years. And we were like, why is it that nobody ever goes and builds more units? And the answer that we found was lenders. Lenders, if you buy a property that's 151 units, a real example, the lender is like, over my dead body, am I going to let you raise more lending to build more units? This is my property. I've got a loan on it. You can't put a single lien on it. Don't borrow a single dollar. You're going to be in breach of my loan. So we understood that this is why nobody had ever done it. And we're like, but we have to find a solution on this, right? To create victory, you have to find a way through. And so after months of brainstorming and calling lenders and calling people and saying, we need to find a solution for this because this is a brilliant idea if you can build more units, because we have free parking, we have free land, we have free zoning, we have free, water and sewer, all of this stuff, it makes it really cheap. But my lender hates the idea, right? So they eventually came back and said, what if you were to raise all of the money you need for the additional units as equity from your existing investors, not some other set of investors, your existing investors? And we were like, let's go back to our lender. So we went back to our lender and said, so what if the partnership itself, you know, donated $3 million to build this new property? Wouldn't you end up with more units in the property? Isn't that better for you? And they're like, yeah. But you got to use the same investors. You can't go out and raise more money from other people. That's another way of creating a lien. So then we went back to our existing investors and told them this business plan that we had, that we wanted to build more units, but we couldn't raise any money. We couldn't get any lending. So they had to give us cash. And so they're like, but that's a problem. We can't just give you cash like this. And we were allowed to raise it from other investors, but we couldn't increase the equity pool. The lender didn't want the equity pool to go up. So we're like, we will create a new asset class. And people will give us money, and they will give, for the moment, because our lender is not letting us be lending, it'll be a separate asset class. As long as we can pay it off at refinance, it becomes lending at that point. And so we go to our lender and say, are you okay with this scenario? Because this is not lending. Nobody's putting a lien on the property. There's nothing. The lender's like, it sounds really weird, but yeah, it makes sense. It's really coming in as equity. So it's at risk. It's behind me in the capital stack. I don't care. So we go and raise $3 million cash. And we go build these 29 units. And those 29 units take us from an 18 IRR to a 38 IRR, something like that, for the property. Because all that money that came in from those rents was net profit. Because the property's expenses remained the same. Its staff remained the same. We didn't pay anything for the land. We didn't pay anything for the utilities. We just built more units. And we built it using money that was not lending, right? And I think that was an incredible victory. And then since then, we've repeated it twice more. So we are the only super value add syndicator in the US. And the key comes from the way that we structure that new equity that comes in, because it's very, very hard to structure it. So financial engineering allowed us to buy a property that's 150 units and exit a 200 unit property.
So wait a minute, you bought 150, built 50 units. Holy
and
Moses.
Sold it at 200.
Wow, that's incredible.
Real examples. You can check those out at our website, because we have case studies and stuff like that. I did the same thing with storage, self-storage. I noticed that there was a self-storage facility, had 700 units already. We built a bunch of new units and a bunch of new covered parkings for RVs, and then put solar on top of those to increase our NOI. And that one, believe it or not, sold for 50 plus IRR.
Wow.
Right. So I think that that's what I'm obsessed with. I want to take existing profitable functional business models. You know, you guys have exited at crazy numbers, you know, in partnerships with us and otherwise. But I think some of that is because there's an all ships rising effect. Super value add works in good markets, bad markets, great markets, and ugly markets, because it's simply creation of value. It's additional creation of value that nobody is, you know, crazy enough to do it. That's why I'm known as the mad scientist. I'm mad enough. Nice.
One of the ideas I got from early from Bigger Pockets was thinking about it from the standpoint of a single family house. Look for a way to add a bedroom, look for a way to add a bathroom. And that you put it on steroids, where you suddenly build 50 units where there was none before. Holy Moses. Wow.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And, and it's hard work, right? You have to have a development division to do it. Development is not something that you can do using the same people. Yeah. So we basically built a development unit first and built regular apartment complexes. Yeah. And then that development unit was then deployed to partner with our value add unit to build additional units. So we're doing one project right now where we're building 42 units at a property that city's already approved. We've already got our lending, our equity put in. And now, and by the way, I 1031 into this property. So I'm really pleased with how well it's going, because I'm actually the biggest LP investor. And nice. I'm the only GP investor, right? So nice. I'm very pleased that we have all the approvals to build another 42 units. And, you know, it becomes a true legacy property. It becomes a whopper, but it also becomes very strong cash flow. So you can, it's almost a pain when you have to sell it, because you're basically taking all that cash flow away from yourself.
Right. Right. Cash flow is good. Yeah. Understand. So Neil, let's just want to, I think we've covered some of our next couple of questions already. So maybe I'll just jump ahead of here. Neil, is there something that you do along the way to try to give back to, you know, people in need somewhere, perhaps your company, something you do personally, something you could share?
Yeah, we do a lot of charity, and 50% of our charity goes to the Philippines. So the Philippines team picks their own charities, usually four a year. Mm-hmm. And so half of our charity budget goes to them, half goes to the US. Each year the team picks it. But the one thing I want to talk about that I think is unique about us is that we make our employees carbon neutral. So in addition to the charity, each year we take a certain percentage of our employees to carbon neutral. A long time ago, I became obsessed with the idea of being carbon neutral because I travel business class all over the world. And that is the most polluting thing that you can ever imagine. You know, flying from here to Dubai is like driving a car 10,000 miles. And so I was a mega polluter. That weighed down on my conscience a great deal. So I did a lot of research. I tried, looked at solar, and everything else was too expensive. What I found eventually was that there's a company, just one single company, that can do something magical. It's called One Tree Planted. And while there's lots of companies that plant trees, this company is truly, truly special. They're a nonprofit because they have leveraged relationships in such a way that by simply planting 1,379 trees, a mega polluter like me became carbon neutral. So I calculated how much carbon I'm putting out every year. The answer is 66,000 pounds of carbon. And then I calculated how many trees eat up 66,000 pounds of carbon. And the answer was 1,379. So I went and basically donated 1,379 trees to One Tree Planted. I became carbon neutral. And then I became obsessed with, well, let's do this for other people. So now in our company, we have a match. Anyone that wants to become carbon neutral, they put in half the donation to One Tree Planted. They post it in Slack. And then a few minutes later, we post our matching donation in Slack. So more and more of our employees are becoming carbon neutral.
Very nice. Very nice. I'll circle back to that at the end, but that's very cool, Neil. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Neil, what's something you've recently implemented in your business that's allowed you to scale the growth rate you guys have at Grow Capitus?
So our brainstorming sessions, remember, they have to be truly batshit crazy. They can't be incremental. They have to be like, you know, big, hairy, audacious goals, right?
Yeah.
So one batshit idea 5 years ago was, well, as a syndicator, you know, we give 70% of our benefits to LPs and we take 30%. What if we could create a project where we get 70% of the profit, but they still make the same amount of money, right? The the LPs can't be harmed, but you have to make the same amount of money. And so we played with lots and lots of different models. We do this all the time. We're constantly throwing all kinds of stuff at the wall to see if it sticks. But the one that really worked for us was a model called fourplex presale. So I built a very, very large, so it took me 2 years to build an extremely large database of very rich people, not accredited investors, because usually those people are comfortable with $100,000. I needed to build a database of people that were comfortable giving me $500,000 at a time and not having any return for 24 months, right? So that's a completely different kind of database. We targeted Facebook, we spent a couple $1 million on it, and we ended up with these people that we knew were capable of doing that. And they basically started building fourplexes where we would go to them and say, give us $500,000. We will build a fourplex for you that you will be the 100% equity owner of for your life. Mm-hmm. I'm not a partner with you. I don't take any portion, no fees. You keep it and the depreciation never gets recaptured. With $100,000 investors, they get the benefit of depreciation when they buy into a syndication property. But when that property is sold, it gets recaptured. They hate right. that, but they don't have a way around it. But if you're rich enough, you can buy a fourplex and the depreciation never gets recaptured. So we basically call it a legacy product. It's basically a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year hold. And we tell them, never sell this sucker. Always right. refinance it. So we have 10 that we're delivering this month in Idaho Falls. Again, you have to pick smaller cities because, as you know, the math would not work in larger cities. Like, I can't build this in Atlanta. You know, the land cost would kill me, right? So it has to be basically super fast growing, you know, unknown cities where I find pieces of land and I convince the city to rezone the land, upzone it from single family to, it takes me a year to do that, to upzone it. But once I upzone it, I now have the country's only product where the general partner makes 100% of the money and the limited partner makes 20% IRR. So I do not give any portion of the equity to my limited partners. So it's 100% general partnership product, but it took 5 years to build.
Yeah.
Right. And it was almost impossible because during that process, we had 7 or 8 different challenges to resolve. Appraisals were a challenge. How do you get that equity? How do you convince people to give you that money 24 months in advance? How do you build them cheap enough so that they're making cash flow? There's a series of challenges. And no point did we think we would actually get a finalized product, but we're delivering them right now. And we're delivering them at IRRs that are 20 to 30% higher than projected. So those investors, wow, they are delighted with the end product. And we're not giving them $1 of the profits.
Wow. That's awesome.
Right. So this is, yeah, you call it new, but you know, in my world, everything takes 3 to 5 years to build.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it's a new model in the fact that you're doing that.
It doesn't exist in the US. So we've checked. We are the only company in the US that that pre-sells fourplexes because it took a long time to find investors that would give us $500,000.
Right. Makes sense. Yeah. Neil, as you look back over your career and your many things you've done, is there some advice you might share with somebody who's looking to make a path change?
Yeah, I think it's very straightforward advice. And you might almost think that it's not worth it, but I assure you it has great value. You know, people ask me, you know, what's the best book to read and things like that, you know, whether it's Rich Dad, Poor Dad or Traction or whatever it is. I find that some books enable others. I think in that sense, the greatest book in the world is The Miracle Morning, because if you can actually implement all 6 portions, they're called savers, SAVERS, of The Miracle Morning and stick with it, the change that it makes to your life is incredible. And it allows you to find your best book, because I can guarantee it's my best book. It's not yours. Your best book is sitting out there somewhere and you haven't read it yet. But Savers requires 20 minutes of reading every day. That's 140 minutes a week. That's a lot of books you're going to read in 52 weeks. So sooner or later, you will find your magical book. And I think that will change your life. So if you're not on The Miracle Morning, get on it.
Nice.
Excellent. Well, Neil, what's the best way for our listeners to reach out and learn more about what you and Grow Capitus and different projects you have going on?
So, you know, in terms of what we do, right? So I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A on Google gets you to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of articles. You can see my conference presentations. a couple hundred podcasts that come up on podchaser.com. But I think you can also add things to it. So you can say Neil space Bawa space virtual assistants, and it'll tell you how I built my team in the Philippines. And you can copy that, or Neil space Bawa space super value add, or Neil space Bawa space fourplexes. I publish all of my research. I don't care about competitors. I think that we always stay ahead. We'll always move ahead, and we'll always have more investors than we know what to do with. So it really doesn't matter to me. So all of this research is all published. I mean, obviously I'm speaking with you about them, so you're going to publish them. So that's the best thing to do, actually, to look at disruptive ideas. Also Neil Bawa PropTech. PropTech is a very powerful vertical that most people in syndication don't understand how to leverage. I think that these concepts, ideas are good. And then another one, Neil Bawa Trends. So each year we publish a presentation on January 17th or thereabouts about the top trends that are driving cap rates that particular year that will drive cap rates down, drive prices up. Obviously, we didn't do well this year because a war started on Feb 23rd and changed a bunch of things. But usually we tend to be right on. And I think that if you watch that trends presentation each year, you're ahead anyway. And some of the trends continue regardless of wars. Like Build-to-Rent was not affected by the war in the Ukraine because it's a new construction product. And so those are very rarely affected. I just signed a construction loan at 4% fixed. And I can't get a value add loan for under 6% right now, but I'm you know signing construction loans for 4%. So it's a different world, different math, different, you know, the way that world works is extremely unique. So Build-to-Rent is another one. So Neil Bawa Build-to-Rent. So I think it's useful to attach these things that we have pioneered. And we didn't get the time to talk about Build-to-Rent, but fourplexes are one kind of Build-to-Rent. We built many different kinds of BTR products.
Nice. That's great, Neil. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Neil, we definitely want to thank you for being on the Road Less Traveled show. Really enjoyed the conversation and learning different aspects you have of your business going on, and always kind of pushing the leading edge on technology there, which is really informative. And like I said, we really appreciate the conversation. Wish you continued success.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, hopefully we'll be back on the show at some point and share some more.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Neil, we really want to thank you for being on. Appreciate it. We also like to thank our listeners. Please continue to give us a 5-star rating so we can bring you more great content like Neil Bawa on our show today. We also want to thank Park Capital Partners that sponsors the show and remind everybody of two things. First, we have the Park Capital Value Add Fund, which is open to accredited investors. It's a 506c fund. And secondly, we also want to just touch on going back to what we alluded to earlier. We last year, Bill and I created the Park Capital Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And Bill and I, through Park Capital Partners, we fund the operations of the foundation. So it's dollars donated go to do its best work, which is to help others. We donate a portion of our profits. We donate personally. And we also, when our investors invest with us, we donate to make a donation to honor them to one of 15 pre-selected charities, of which one is One Tree Planet. And we feel that's a good way to give back to the community. We believe it's our responsibility as people who are very blessed to give back. So that's why we do this. And again, thank you again so much for being on, Neil. Appreciate it. And remember, folks, the road less traveled may be calling you. We recommend that you listen and take action. Thanks for joining.